Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info. Why is Abraham considered our father of faith when so much of his biblical biography details his utter lack of faith? He laughed in God's face about a son from a barren wife. Then he tried to go around God's prophecy for that son. He lied to two different kings about his relationship with Sarah, putting her in real danger. We'll explore this in the following discussion by Hallel Fellowship teacher Daniel on the Torah Parashah, or portion called Vayera, which means he appeared. It covers Genesis 18 through 22. In it, we will learn that despite Abraham's and Sarah's ups and downs, their faith was growing, not shrinking. That is why God himself not only credited Abraham's trust as righteousness, but also made them patriarch and matriarch of a great and mighty nation. Through them, all nations of the earth would be blessed, particularly by their greatest descendant, Yeshua HaMashiach, or Jesus the Christ.
We are covering Genesis, not all the whole book, but part of it. Genesis 18 through 22. This is we go through the story as far as the offering up of Isaac, and which is always a fun topic to discuss, isn't it? So starting out in Genesis 18, the name of this is He Appeared, or Vayera. Genesis 18. The Lord appeared to him in the plains of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. He lifted his eyes and saw, and behold, three men were standing over him. He perceived, so he ran toward them from the entrance of the tent and bowed toward the ground. And he said, My Lord, if I find favor in your eyes, please pass not away from your servant. Let some water be brought and wash your feet and recline beneath the tree. I will fetch a morsel of bread that you may sustain yourselves. Then go on, inasmuch as you have passed your servant's way. They said, Do so, just as you have said. So Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, Hurry, three seahs of meal, fine flour, knead and make cakes. Then Abraham ran to the cattle, took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the youth who hurried to prepare it. He took cream and milk and the calf which he had prepared, and placed these before them. He stood over them beneath the tree as they ate. They said to him, Where is Sarah, your wife? And he said, Behold, in the tent. And he said, I will surely return to you at this time next year, and behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Now Sarah was listening at the entrance of the tent which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well on in years. The manner of women had ceased to be with Sarah. And Sarah laughed at herself, saying, After I have withered, shall I again have delicate skin? And my husband is old. The Lord said to Abraham, Why is it that Sarah laughed, saying, Shall I in truth bear a child, though I have aged? Is anything beyond the Lord? At the appointed time, I'll return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son. But Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was affrighted. But he said, No, you laughed indeed. So the men got up from there and gazed down toward Sodom with Abraham, while Abraham walked with them to escort them. The Lord said, Shall I conceal from Abraham what I do? Now that Abraham is surely to become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by him. For I have loved him, because he commands his children and his household after him, that they may keep the way of the Lord, doing charity and justice, in order that the Lord might then bring upon Abraham that which he had spoken of him. So the Lord said, Because the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah has become great, and because their sin has been very grave, I will descend and see if they act in accordance with its outcry, which has come to me, then destruction. And if not, I will know. The men turned from there and went to Sodom, while Abraham was still standing before the Lord. Abraham came forward and said, "Will you also stamp out the righteous along with the wicked? What if there should be 50 righteous people in the midst of that city? Would you still stamp it out, rather than spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people within it? It would be a sacrilege to you to do such a thing, to bring death upon the righteous along with the wicked. So the righteous will be like the wicked. It would be sacrilege to you. Shall the judge of all the earth not do justice?" The Lord said, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous people in the midst of the city, I will spare the entire place on their account." Abraham responded and said, "Behold now, I desire to speak to my Lord, although I am but dust and ash. What if the 50 righteous people should lack 5? Would you destroy the entire city because of the 5? He said, "I will not destroy it if I find there 45. He further continued to speak to him and said, "What if 40 would be found there?" And he said, "I will not act on account of the 40. And then he said, "Let not my Lord be annoyed, and I will speak. What if 30 would be found there?" And he said, "I will not act if I find there 30. And so he said, "Behold now, I desire to speak to my Lord. What if 20 would be found there?" And he said, "I will not destroy on the account of the 20. And so he said, "Let my Lord not be annoyed, and I will speak but this once. What if 10 will be found there?" And he said, "I will not destroy on account of the 10. The Lord departed when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Chapter 19. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. Now Lot saw and stood up to meet them, and he bowed, faced the ground. He said, "Behold now, my lords, turn about, please, to your servant's house. Spend the night and wash your feet. Then wake up early and go your way." And they said, "No. Rather, we will spend the night in the square." And he urged them very much. So they turned toward him and came to his house. He made a feast for them and baked matzot, and they ate. They had not yet lain down when the townspeople, Sodomites, converged upon the house, from young to old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them." Lot went out to them, to the entrance, and shut the door behind him. He said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act wickedly. See now, I have 2 daughters who have never known a man. I shall bring them out to you, and do to them as you please. But to these men do nothing, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." And he said, "Stand back." Then they said, "This fellow came to sojourn and would act as a judge? Now we will treat you worse than them." They pressed exceedingly upon the man, upon Lot, and they approached to break the door. The men stretched out their hand and brought Lot into the house with them, and closed the door. The men who were at the entrance of the house, they were struck with blindness, from small to great, and they tried vainly to find the entrance. Then the men said to Lot, "Whom else do you have here? A son-in-law, your sons, your daughters? All that you have in the city, remove from the place, for we are about to destroy this place, for their outcry has become great before the Lord, so the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and spoke to his son-in-laws, and the betrothed of his daughters, and said, "Get up, leave this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city." But he seemed like a jester in the eyes of his son-in-laws. Just as dawn was breaking, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Get up, Take your wife and your two daughters who are present, lest you be swept away because of the sin of the city. Still he lingered. So the men grasped him by his hand, his wife's hand, and the hand of his two daughters, in the Lord's mercy upon him. And they took him out, and left him outside the city. And it was, as they took them out, that one said, Flee for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountain, lest you be swept away. And Lot said to them, Please, no, my lord. See now, your servant has found grace in your eyes, and your kindness was great, which you did with me, to save my life. But I cannot escape to the mountain, lest the evil attach itself to me and I die. Behold, please, this city is near enough to escape, and it is small. I shall flee there. Is it not small? And then I will live. He replied to him, Behold, I have granted you consideration, even regarding this, that I not overturn the city about which you have spoken. Hurry, flee there, for I cannot do a thing until you arrive there. He therefore called the name of the city Zoar. The sun rose upon the earth, and Lot arrived at Zoar. Now the Lord had caused sulfur and fire to rain upon Sodom and Gomorrah, from the Lord out of heaven. He overturned these cities and the entire plain with all the inhabitants of the cities and the vegetation of the soil. His wife peered behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Abraham arose early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He gazed down upon Sodom and Gomorrah, and the entire surface of the land of the plain, and saw, and behold, the smoke of the earth rose like the smoke of a kiln. And so it was, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham. So he sent Lot from amidst the upheaval, when he overturned the cities in which Lot had lived. Now Lot went up from Zoar and settled on the mountain, his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to remain in Zoar. He dwelt in a cave, he with his two daughters. The older one said to the younger, Our father is old, and there is no man in the land to marry us in the usual manner. Come, let us ply our father with wine, and lie with him, that we may give life to offspring through our father. So they plied their father with wine on that night. The older one came and lie with her father. He was not aware of her lying down and of her getting up. And it was the next day the older one said to the younger, Behold, I lay with my father last night. Let us ply him with wine tonight as well. And you come and lie with him, that we give life to offspring through our father. So they plied their father with wine that night also. The younger one got up and lay with him. He was not aware of her lying down and of her getting up. Thus Lot's two daughters conceived from their father. The older one bore a son. She called his name Moab. He is the ancestor of Moab to this day. The young one also bore a son. She called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the ancestor of the children of Ammon until this day. Chapter 20. Abraham journeyed from there to the region of the south and settled between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, She is my sister. So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah, and God came to Abimelech in a dream by night, and said to him, Behold, you are to die, because of the woman you have taken. Moreover, she is a married woman. Now Abimelech had not approached her, so he said, O my lord, will you slay a nation, even though it is righteous? Did he not himself tell me, She is my sister? And she to herself said, He is my brother. In the innocence of my heart and integrity of my hands have I done this. And God said to him in the dream, I too know it was in the innocence of your heart that you did this. And I too prevented you from sinning against me. That is why I did not permit you to touch her. But now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not return her, beware that you shall surely die, you and all that is yours. Abimelech arose early the next morning. He summoned all the servants and told them all these things in their ears. And the people were very frightened. Then Abimelech summoned Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? How have I sinned against you, that you brought upon me and my kingdom such a great sin? Deeds that ought not be done have you done to me?" Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you should do such a thing?" Abraham said, "Because I said, there is but no fear of God in this place, and they will slay me because of my wife. Moreover, she is indeed my sister, my father's daughter, though not my mother's daughter. And she became my wife. And so it was, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'Let this be your kindness which you shall do for me. To whatever place we come, say of me, he is my brother.'" So Abimelech took flocks and cattle and servants and maidservants and gave to Abraham, and he returned his wife Sarah to him. Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Settle where you see fit." And to Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, let it be for you an eye covering for all who are with you, and to all you will be vindicated." Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, and his maids, and they were relieved. The Lord had completely restrained every orifice of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, the wife of Abraham. Chapter 21. The Lord had remembered Sarah as he said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he spoken. Sarah conceived and bore a son unto Abraham in his old age, at the appointed time which God had spoken. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah had borne him, Isaac. Abraham circumcised Isaac, his son, at the age of 8 days, as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Sarah said, "God has made laughter for me. Whoever hears will laugh for me." And she said, "Who is the one who said to Abraham, 'Sarah would nurse children'? For I have borne a son in his old age." The child grew and was weaned. Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. So she said to Abraham, "Drive out this slave woman with her son, for the son of that slave woman shall not inherit with my son Isaac." The matter greatly distressed Abraham regarding his son. So God said to Abraham, "Be not distressed over the youth or your slave woman. Whatever Sarah tells you, heed her voice, since through Isaac will offspring be considered yours. But the son of the slave woman as well I will make into a nation, for he is your offspring." So Abraham awoke early in the morning, took bread and a skin of water, and gave them to Hagar. He placed them on her shoulder along with the boy, and sent her off. She departed and strayed in the desert of Beersheba. When the water of the skin was consumed, she cast off the boy beneath one of the trees. She went and sat herself down at a distance, a bow's shot away. For she said, "Let me not see the death of the child." And she sat at a distance, lifted her voice, and wept. Now God heard the cry of the youth, and an angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What troubles you, Hagar? Fear not. For God has heeded the cry of your youth in his present state. Arise, lift up the youth, grasp your hand upon him. I will make a great nation of him." Then God opened her eyes, and she perceived a well of water. She went and filled the skin with water and gave the youth to drink. God was with the youth, and he grew up. He dwelt in the desert and became an accomplished archer. He lived in the desert of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. At that time, Abimelech and Pichol, general of his legion, said to Abraham, God is with you in all that you do. Now swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my grandson, according to the kindness that I have done with you. Do with me and with the land in which you have sojourned. Abraham said, I will swear. Then Abraham disputed with Abimelech regarding the well of water that Abimelech's servants had seized. But Abimelech said, I do not know who did this thing. Furthermore, you have never told me. And moreover, I myself have heard nothing of it except for today. So Abraham took flocks and cattle and gave them to Abimelech. And the two of them entered into a covenant. Abraham set 7 ewes of the flock by themselves. Abimelech said to Abraham, What are these 7 ewes which you have set by themselves? And he replied, Because you are to take these 7 ewes from me, that may serve me as a testimony that I dug this well. Therefore, that place was called Beersheba, because there the 2 men of them took an oath. Thus they entered into a covenant at Beersheba, and Abimelech then arose with Pichol, his general of his legion, and they returned to land of the Philistines. He planted in Eshel in the Beersheba, and there he proclaimed the name of the Lord, God of the universe. And Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many years. Chapter 22. And it happened after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, he replied, Here I am. He said, Please take your son, your only one whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. Bring him up there as an offering upon one of the mountains which I shall tell you. So Abraham awoke early the next morning, and he saddled his donkey. He took his 2 young men with him and Isaac, his son. He split the wood for the offering and stood up and went to the place of which God had spoken to him. On the 3rd day, Abraham raised his eyes and perceived the place from afar. Abraham said to his young men, Stay here by yourselves with the donkey, while I and the lad go yonder. We will worship, and we will return to you. Abraham took the wood for the offering and placed it on Isaac, his son. He took the hand of the fire, and the knife, and the 2 of them went together. Then Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, Father, he said, Here I am, my son. He said, Here are the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the offering? Abraham said, God will seek out for himself the lamb for the offering, my son. The 2 of them went together. They arrived at the place of which God had spoken to him. Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood. He bound Isaac, his son, and he placed him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. An angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. He said, Here I am. He said, Do not stretch out your hand against the lad, nor do anything to him. For now I know that you are a God-fearing man, since you have not withheld your son, your only one, from me. Abraham raised his eyes and saw, and behold, a ram. Afterwards, caught by the thicket of his horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as an offering instead of his son. Abraham called the name of that place, The Lord Yireh. As is said this day, on the mountain God will be seen. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a 2nd time from heaven. He said, By myself I swear, the word of the Lord, that because you have done this thing, and have not withheld your son, your only one, that I shall surely bless you and greatly increase your offspring, like the stars of the heavens, like the sand on the seashore, and your offspring shall inherit the gate of its enemy. And all the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your offspring, because you have listened to my voice. Abraham returned to his young men, and they stood up and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham stayed at Beersheba. It came to pass as these things that Abraham was told, saying, Behold, Milcah too has borne children to Nahor, your brother. Uz, his firstborn, Buz, his brother, Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Hesed, Hazo, Pildash, Jidlaf, and Bethel. Bethel begot Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother, and his concubine, whose name was Rumah, also bore children, Teba, Gaham, Tahash, and Makah. A lot of reading. Long story. So that's Genesis 18 through 22, also known as Viera, which is He Appeared. Before I get into my little spiel and talk about today and the various topics and issues that got up this chapter, this section, there's a lot in this, by the way, in case you haven't noticed. There's no way I'm covering all of it, but I'll cover what I can. Any questions, comments, things that caught your attention, said, what's that mean? Why did we do that? And what's God meant or intended by that that idea? While you're thinking about that. Yes, David, go ahead.
Little off subject, but I think that there must be something to the Hebrew speaking of least and great, small and great. There's many references that I notice in the Bible. And as we're reading, for example, in Genesis 19:11, where it's talking about all the people that came to Lot's house, it refers to them as all small from and great. Small to great. And then, again, we see that same term used in Jeremiah when it's talking about the new covenant. You know, when he's talking about, and he uses the term least and great. And then again in Matthew, like 5:19, those will be called least.
Least and great, right.
Right. And I was just wondering what, you know, that has to be some kind of, you know, how do you say it, where it has more meaning than just the actual words, like it's some kind of, you know.
Allegory behind it.
Yes.
An intent.
Thank you.
Right. I personally have not researched that to answer your question. No doubt it probably is, but I have not researched to answer it. So traditionally, small and great just means those who are important and unimportant. But there's probably a lot more to it since I think it's cited one more place too. Could be wrong though.
It does say you'll use
yeah.
Wise.
That's true.
That could be your
it could be. Either. Now, in prophets, it also refers, I believe it's either Isaiah or Amos, I can't remember, one of those two, refer to not least and great, but as a head and tail, implying, you know, an idea of what it means to be a head versus a tail. In that case, that instance, as Isaiah says, he cuts off the head, I think also the tail too, I can't remember, referring, and it explains who they happen to be, those who lead you, as well as those who are your prophets, those who tell you what the future is going to hold, both of which God would take away. So your least and your great, the prophet is the one who's trying to earn money, trying to make, say, believe me, like your fortune teller. And then, of course, there's the head saying, go here, go there, we're going to here and there. So the least and great, they have meanings. They have their meanings, but I would have to research to know all the instances and what symbolically it would mean. And I did not do that, so I can't answer your question well enough.
It occurred to me that when Jesus is blessing the children, or that the death scene, that he also says the least of these, and he's referring to the children, so perhaps in the translation it has to do with little people and large people.
It could be. Sodom and Gomorrah, I would hope the children weren't there. Really hope the children weren't there, but I don't know. Yes.
So, let's see. The king of Egypt took Abraham's...
Correct.
Abimelech, king of Gerar, who apparently knew Yahweh,
knew of him, yeah.
Knew of him, at least that much.
Yep.
Took her again.
Again, yes.
Now, they both didn't know that she was his wife.
Mm-hmm.
What gave them the right? Do you understand? I mean, was this a natural practice in those days?
Yeah. Two issues are brought up by this. Oh, so go ahead. You a follow-up as well?
No, that's right. That's
okay.
Right.
I will be covering this a little bit more in detail later. As far as practices in that time period, or as far as that age, which is not much different, the Europeans did the same thing, is that the kings had great power and dominion over their subjects as far as taking, I want this woman, I want that woman, who cares what it is. as long as theoretically she's not already betrothed or taken. That was common in Europe. Now, in Middle East, prior to the institution of God, as far as saying, hey, there's right and wrong, kings were still looked on as descendants of gods. So if a god came down and said, hey, Joe Blow number 8, go do XYZ. And Joe Blow would say, okay, and go do it. Because it's a god, right? And that's the belief of God. Now, in the case of Pharaoh, he was obviously, and we have records many times, of considered a descendant of the gods. And I forgot which one. I think it was the sun god, I think, was the most common one they chose. As far as what he was descendant of. Of course he was, and he was just a man. But that's where they came, their philosophy of, a god is asking you to do this because that was their belief. Now, in the case of Abimelech, which his name is funny, my father is king. It's a common name. But the idea is that even though he may not have been considered a god himself, we have the same philosophy today in that God, our Father, he selects who our leaders are. Yeah, we are inconsequential voters, but reality is who wins is based upon his will. He says, I'm choosing this one or I'm choosing that one. And the philosophy, belief that God is the one who selects the leader, thus the leader is somehow godly. A view that are juxtaposed that with another issue, which I'll draw up here. Which, this is a religion at the time was still in its early state, but was gaining in popularity. So you have, you've heard of Baal, right? And his Asherah. And they have a son. Whatever the son is, who cares? It's the name of a son. What if some happens to be? The belief is that this god and this goddess have this son. Now, in the kings are taking, we have the king of Israel, northern tribes in particular, they grasp this idea and say, oh, well, clearly Baal is the earthly representation of our king, or king's representation of Baal, and our queen here, right? And they start worshiping or using their king and queen as a worship entity, something which you would pray to. That was commonly done in the northern tribes. Now, they didn't invent this off the top of their heads. This is a philosophy being developed over the years, of many generations prior, of inventing that the king is somehow someone that you can pray to and grant you things. Now, the philosophy also comes from the practical side. If I have a need, I go to the king and say, hey, king, I need XYZ. And the king says, I grant you this or I grant you that. He's acting like a god. So the idea is ingrained inside the people that if you need something, go to the king for it. Because the king has this power, can grant you food, can grant you property, can grant you a new wife, or whatever else you want. So that's the king can do. This idea that, well, if the king has that on the physical earth, then he must also symbolically be that in heaven above. Thus the idea of the king and Baal being symbolic or one and the same as each other. So if Baal, the king, says, I want that person as a wife, my new Asherah, the people say, okay, go do it, go get it, whatever you want, it's all yours. That's where the idea is, where the idea is coming from, the idea that if you rule over men physically on earth, thus you must have great spiritual power, because you rule over men's lives. Make sense as far as how the idea comes from? As a result, kings have lots of leeway of, I wish this, I want that, and they get it. Because the people assure the fact they're going to get it. Well, Islam covers women for a lot of other reasons too. I'm not covering those today. There's a lot of things go on in what they choose to do in their traditions, but hopefully that makes sense as far as how he got the idea that he could do this to begin with. Any questions or comments so far? Kat, you first.
In 1933, he was not aware of her lying down and getting up. Both
yes.
Of them. How is that possible?
Well, I'm not Lot, so I can't tell you what he was or wasn't thinking or feeling necessarily. However, Lot is not a young man anymore. He's an old man. Abraham was 100 years old this time, or near to it. Abraham was one of the brothers, and Lot, of course, was his nephew. We don't know the age of what Lot's father was when Lot was born, but Lot is an old man now. If you get an old man drunk, those of you who have had fathers who are drunk, or you yourself may be drunk, how much do you know or aware of? Very little. Very, very little. So that has its inherent problems with as far as when you plaster somebody, they're not aware of a whole lot. But there's more to what Lot's daughters did. And we'll discuss that when we get there. It's a Hebrew word switch that was given to what their actions were. And it ties in what they were doing and their reasoning behind it on what they said they were doing. So when we get to that, their story, we'll go into detail as far as what they were thinking when they did it. It tells you the story what they were generally thinking, but there's more to it than just that. And has to do with, it's recorded in Deuteronomy more about what their train of thought was. So I can't speak what Lot was thinking or feeling, but as far as what the two daughters were thinking, we'll get a little more into that when we get there. Any questions or comments regarding that issue? Oh, yes.
Quick comment, just going back to Abimelech just for one second.
Yes.
God warned the people of Israel when they were wanting to choose Saul as their king of the very same thing.
Yep.
He's going to take your choice young men and send them to war to die. He's going to take your beautiful women and make them, you know, either servants or concubines in his harem. He warned them of all that, and that's what kings do.
Yep.
So,
nothing new.
What is it, the old saying, absolute power corrupts absolutely?
Yep, it does. And when people grant power that way, that's what it's going to facilitate. If I give you my rights, you'll take them and use them. That's what it works to do. Yes.
So when the word mocking is used, are you going to address the word mocking? Okay,
great. We'll discuss that when we get to Ishmael.
I did a lot of...
Yeah, we'll discuss that. I'm not going to go through every detail of the Hebrew word, but I'm going to use the record as far as what Ishmael was doing. Some of you record he was playing... In your Bible, so he was playing at the time with Isaac. It's not a playing as in, oh, hey, let's play cards, let's play ball. It's a playing as in, I'm making fun of or I'm making you feel bad about yourself.
The same word is used later on when he sees a couple playing... And it has a whole sexual connotation.
Right. In that case, it was Rebecca and Isaac being observed.
Right.
Yes. That was also by Abimelech, but I think it's a different Abimelech. But yes, it was also the king of the Philistines did actually watch Rebecca and Isaac playing together. Same word
same
choice.
Same Hebrew word, right?
It's, okay. Yes, same Hebrew word. But it's used, because it's context used in different, it applies differently. But either way, in the case of Ishmael's instance, I believe it's... I forgot. I have written down as far as the address. We'll get there. As far as Ishmael's, he was doing something in particular to Isaac in order to cause problems, which we'll get to that. Yes, Kat again.
I'm curious. Like, why do you think God agreed with Sarah to send Hagar out when she said, get rid of her?
We'll talk about that too.
Okay.
That's part of it. If I can get to all this stuff, we'll talk about this stuff too. Hopefully I'll get to all of it. It's a lot of stuff to cover. I realize it's not easy to cover every detail, but we'll cover what we can. So any comments, any other things I can rattle off to you? Any questions? Yep, let's get going. All right. Okay, my markers. We'll try this one. So in those of you who are aware of this, obviously Abraham is lauded as a great faith-filled man, right? He believed God because he believed God. God gave him righteousness or attributed righteousness to him. So he's a great faith-filled person. These stories are some strange issues if you have a full of faith, right? You notice that some of these stories? In particular, let's start out with the first part when these three men come into Abraham and say, okay, you're going to have a son. Now that was recorded again back to Abraham in chapter 16 of Genesis. What did Abraham do at that time? Do you remember what he did when God first said, I'm going to have a son you're going to have a son through Sarah? What did Abraham do? He laughed. When these men come, at that time, Abraham laughed. He laughed. He said, no, take Ishmael. May, if I spell it right. Instead, Because it's good enough. And at that time, this is back in Genesis 16 and 17. And God said, no, no, it's going to be through your son. Abraham's issue, he laughed. Was he laughing saying, oh, how wonderful this is going to be. I'm going to have a son through Sarah? No. What was he laughing about? It's not possible. He didn't believe. He didn't think it was possible. Now, what is the idea and concept behind faith? Right? Yeah, it's the belief. It's the belief that's a big deal here. So Abraham laughed at God at the time back in 16 and 17. And in this instance, Sarah's turn is to laugh. So do either one of them show an abundance of faith and trust and belief in God? No. So why is he considered one of the faith-filled people, the entire Bible, one to be looked up to? Clearly, this instance shows he was not faithful. So Abraham's, at this instance, he lacked faith. So did Sarah. It's Abraham's faith and Sarah's faith. Sarah's here is included. Both Abraham and Sarah's faith lacked in this story about the whole idea of Isaac. And there's a reason why. This section, which we're reading, we're discussing from Genesis, actually it started previous reading section. It's a story sequence showing us how Abraham's faith is growing and how it changes with time. Because mind you, when we say God, he chose Abraham, okay, he chose Abraham to choose of all the people to choose. Why? Oh, well, because he believed God. Really? Well, the story says he didn't. So the story says Sarah didn't either. And what about also when he goes to Pharaoh? Oh, well, she's my sister. Really? Where's the faith there? Goes to Abimelech, she's my sister. Where's the faith there? If he's this faith-filled patriarch of all humanity, all they should bless by him, he is showing repeated examples of an acute lack of faith. But he believes something. We're going to discuss this section. What is it that Abraham and God were working together, and how was God working and teaching Abraham along the way to grow something inside him they didn't have? Yes, Kate.
I just think Lorianne and I have talked about it before, just how all of us have to go through this process where we continuously learn that God has us, that he has our best interest, that he is honest and truthful and faithful. And to get to a point where you are willing to sacrifice your child
the epitome
is trusting him with your heart, with your life, with everything.
Right.
But none of us start out that way. And I think it is what makes Abraham human in the writings, is that you watch him grow and struggle and doubt. And God going, hey, I told you
this
is going this way. Yeah.
And that's how a lot of faith works. And God didn't say, come out of Ur of Chaldean, Abraham, and go kill your son. Those weren't the words that God used. He said, come out, I'll show you a great land, lots of promises, lots of good things. Oh yeah, here's some trials, I'll help you with that. He worked his way through. And we're discussing some of these workings and how the Bible explains how Abraham's faith worked and why God liked him so much. Yes, David.
Well, I don't want to take away from Jeff's next week, but you know, if you go forward to 26:5, I think it explains that quite clearly, unless I'm
it does
mistaking.
Yeah, it does.
Okay,
it explains a lot as far as what's happening in this story as well as in Abraham's life. It explains it, the Torah, how we're getting there. We're not there until 26 yet. That's cheating. You no jumping ahead. So in this story, so far we have Abraham showing examples of lack of faith in the laughing of this birth of the child. And of course, Sarah's as well. Now, in this instance, did God get after Abraham for laughing back in, you know, chapter 16 and 17? No, he didn't. He didn't get after him. Even though Abraham argued, no, take Ishmael instead. God said, no, I don't want him. I'll give you your own son. God didn't get mad at him for laughing. Now God got after Sarah for laughing. So, that's not fair. how can you get after? It's like two children. Wait, you can't punish me if so and so gets away with it too. That's how usually it works, right? Well, in this instance, it doesn't quite work that way. In Sarah's laugh and God getting after, keep in mind it's not an anger. God's not angry with her because there is no exclamation marks in Hebrew. There's no shouting, okay? It doesn't say, oh, in punctuation with question marks and commas and dots, emoticons or bold-faced print. It doesn't do that. God just says, no, indeed, you laugh, because you was afraid. There's no show of anger. Now, is God full of anger? No. He's full of love, right? So are you going to have a loving father be angry with you and yelling at you? Not generally, unless you're really, really screwed up. But generally, no. He wants to help you through the process. So it's not through anger that he's getting after Sarah. He's just pointing out that, no, you did indeed laugh because she was frightened. Abraham did not deny his laughter, by the way. When he laughed, he admittedly laughed. He said so. So we're showing it, starting out examples of a lack of faith. And this is where we're going to explain a little detail as far as who Abraham is and what makes him what he was and why God liked him so much. So in chapter 18, first of all, by the way, this is following up the sequence or time which Abraham has been circumcised. We don't know how many days have elapsed from the time of circumcision to where these three men show up. It's all within 1 year. But we don't know the exact time. It could be, some have argued it's only a few days later, so he's relatively in pain, but I don't really know for certain. So of course he sees three men standing before him. He doesn't know who they are. They just showed up one day. It's obviously the heat of the day. He doesn't know who they are, but what is Abraham's first reaction?
Bows down.
What's that show? He sees something about them. Something important about them. So Abraham's faith, I mean, let's go through a cycle. The first task he does, he bows down. And what's the following sequence of events? Go ahead.
You're actually forgetting something he does before.
He sees.
No, he ran.
Oh, right. That's true. He did rush.
Normally.
That is true.
Normally, when you have a situation of someone who's of superior rank to another, the one of superior rank would not run towards the one of inferior rank.
That's true.
So the fact that he's running towards these men shows that he sees something in them that makes it obvious to him, at least, that these people are superior to him in some way.
They are superior. That's true. Now, bowing down generally implies a similar idea. But that's true. He does recognize or perceive that they are of some greater than himself. So he is treating him in a particular way. Of course, what does he do? He invites him over. Says, "If I have found favor in your eyes, please don't pass by your servant." He's invited him to eat. So he obviously refers to himself as a servant, which is fine. To serve them. Serve them food. That's his offering. Does he know these men? Has he ever met them before? Not that he knows of, no. He knows nothing about them. This sequence should look identical to what Lot did, right? What was Lot's event? He bowed low. It shows to the ground. Let's write this correctly. My penmanship's also grim. And he offers them a place of lodging and food for the angels. So he's lodging. And Abraham, of course, doesn't offer lodging, but offers the food. Of course, he ends up serving the food. See a similarity so far? Both men come from the same family, which means same family tradition. They both treat their guests, who they have never met before, with a state of being. We call the state of being deference and charity. All right? Both men treat guests, random strangers, with a sense of deference and charity. These are important concepts. Very important. You want to understand Abraham's mental thought and why God selected him versus all other men? That's step one. Deference and charity. What does deference mean? To defer to somebody else. You're greater than me. What do you want? That's what it means. What do you want? You make the decision. What would you like? I'll do whatever you come up with. Whatever comes out of your mouth, I'll do it. It's deferring to your choice. You are greater than I am. And then, charity, I give. And I give. And I give. And keep giving. This is the beginning of where Abraham was selected. This is why he was chosen by God. This is where he started. He doesn't end here. There's more to it. And the story about his discussion with Sodom and Gomorrah explains, God himself even says so in the Torah, in this section, as far as why God is choosing Abraham. Now note, Lot treats God the same way, but God didn't choose Lot. Because Lot had one thing he lacked that Abraham had. I want to read about that. So, he brings them food and water. Obviously, they eat. They say, go ahead and do so. Where is Sarah, your wife? Behold, a son. We've read that part as far as the idea of her laughing. Let's see here. And then it says in verse 17 of chapter 18, this is Abraham is walking with all three men. They're standing there looking out over Sodom area, the Sodom and Gomorrah. The Lord says, shall I conceal from Abraham what I do? Now that Abraham is surely to become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed themselves by him. For I have loved him because he commands his children and his household after him that they keep the way of the Lord, doing charity and justice, in order the Lord might then bring upon Abraham that which he had spoken of him. So what was God's reason for selecting Abraham? Because he teaches his children and grandchildren to obey charity and justice and everything the Lord tells them to do. What's the issue? What's God's hanging his hat on Abraham, saying, I'm choosing you. You're the best, poorest person because of what? His sense of charity and a sense of justice. And that he will teach his children following. Now, the first part of 18, we just got a glimpse of his sense of charity. Now, it shows us the charity in many other places prior to the earlier stories as well. We have examples of Abraham and his charity, his kindness to others. We'll also show it again when he buys a plot of land for his dead wife, the mass amount of money he's willing to spend on this plot of land for his dead wife. He's not quibbling about it. His sense of charity is very, very strong. He's giving things to strangers who he doesn't know. How many of you give things to people you've never met before? Not including taxes, doesn't count. Some of you frequently, but some of you not so often. You never met, I know nothing about you, don't even know your name, never heard of you before, never seen you before. Why would I give you anything? You haven't asked for it either. Did the men ask for any food? No. Did they ask for lodge or anything else? No. He just offered it to them. So his sense of charity is very, very strong. But his sense of justice trumps it. Unlike Lot's charity, which was equally as strong as Abraham's. But Lot's sense of justice fell short. Let's continue on with this story. So God explains to him in verse 19, about why he's choosing him, because why God is blessing and intending to bless Abraham, his sense of charity and justice, that they might raise his children and keep them going along the commandments, that in order the Lord bless them. Then the Lord speaks out, of course, he's about Sodom and Gomorrah. Their sin has become great. I will descend and see for myself. I have a question for you. We've talked about this previously before. I won't erase it just yet. Can God see what happens in Sodom and Gomorrah without going down there to look at it? Yeah. He knows your hearts and your minds. He knows the hairs in your head. He can probably figure out, hey, look what the guys of Sodom and Gomorrah are doing. Does he need to go down there to look at it? No, not at all. So why would he even say this? Why would he tell Abraham this? What was God's intent? Was his intention to figure out how bad Sodom and Gomorrah really were? Was that his goal? Because he just didn't know, just couldn't figure it out? Or was his intent all along to get Lot and his family out? See, Lot and his family aren't going to flee by some dream Lot has. Oh, God told me I should move and go along this way. No, God talks with Abraham that way. Lot just tagged along with Abraham. God spoke to Abraham in dreams and speaking to him, but not Lot. Lot does his own thing. So Lot's not going to follow God through a dream. God literally took his hand, the angels took his hand and dragged him outside the city and said, go. Took his wife and his children and dragged them all out and said, go, because he's not going to go otherwise. So what was the objective of visiting the city? Was it to check out how bad the city was? No, it was to get Lot and his family physically out because God knew Lot and his family weren't going to want to go. That's what they did. Yes.
And interestingly, when you go down the numbers of, you know, where he bargains with God, He stops at 10.
Stops at 10. Was a reason.
How many were there left?
Yeah. There's a reason he stopped at 10. You're right. Abraham knew how many people in Sodom were good. He knew Lot was good. His wife was good. He has at least four daughters. Now, those four daughters, I don't know how, if Abraham knew all of them were married or not. He most likely knew at least two of them were married, and probably, since it says one was betrothed, it was probably one that was married too. Adding all those up, that covers your 10. That covers your 10, assuming they have good husbands. It turned out they didn't. But he didn't necessarily know their husbands that well. So Abraham was hoping, I guess, maybe beyond reason, that at least Lot's family would be at least 10 good people to spare the city. So in this sequence, God can figure out what's wrong with Sodom without having to go down to visit. However, the angels had to go move Lot. So what was God's objective all along? To move Lot. That was his goal. He wanted to make sure the righteous, as Abraham points out, don't perish with the wicked. Now note, he sends them to Sodom. Did God send anybody to Gomorrah? Apparently there was no one in Gomorrah worthwhile saving. It just wasn't. There wasn't even 10. I guess it wasn't even 1. Because he doesn't say, show anything. He sent anybody to them. So maybe Gomorrah was a little bit worse. But the objective was to move Lot. That was God's goal. So Abraham goes through this cycle of, we call it negotiating or whittling down. It's not so much a whittling down as in convincing God that he should save a city. We're trying to understand Abraham and how he thinks. Not how God thinks. We know what God thinks. He said the angel's going to wipe out Sodom. That was pretty obvious. But what does Abraham think? Because we understand Abraham's idea of charity. But now in the story of negotiation, we understand what he means by justice. There's a difference. Now, Abraham points out to God a few times in this cycle, in this discussion, as far as when after God explains that he's going to wipe out the city. And he points out, will you destroy the wicked? Far be it from you. This is the verse 25. It would be a sacrilege to you to do such a thing, to bring death upon the righteous along with the wicked, so that the righteous will be like the wicked. It would be sacrilegious to you. Shall the judge of all the earth not do justice? So Abraham's pointing out that, hey, it's not justice to wipe out these cities when there's righteous people in it. So what's his sense of justice? You would rather have a city full of wickedness with a few righteous people in it than have them all perish. His idea of justice is much like the whole idea, I'd rather have, you know, 100 guilty men go free than one man stay a day in prison. It's the same idea. Protect the few good, and it's worth the losses of all the misery and hatred and evil that goes along in it. That's Abraham's idea of justice. Now, he starts out with 50. 50 people was a lot of people. I don't know how big the city of Sodom and Gomorrah was, but there's a few. So he's whittling himself down. Obviously, he stops at 10. God knows what number he's stopping at. God already has ahead of time. He knows what his plan is. But Abraham's idea of justice, it shows us what his train of thought is. So 50 righteous people is worth saving. All the wicked, and let them live. But his idea goes all the way down to 10. So in Abraham's mind, the whole city is worth saving for 10 people. Now, would we say that? Not generally. In a modern day world, no, if you have a city full of wickedness, you have 10 good people. Oh, well, they shouldn't have lived there anyway. Let's trash it. Get rid of it. Well, our sense of justice isn't just, is it? What's Abraham's sense of justice? It is just. It's saving the wicked in order for the few righteous is how we're understanding and seeing Abraham's thinking. So when God says he has charity and justice, what's God anticipating Abraham teaching his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren? Charity and justice. And his idea of justice. And so we're seeing in this story the example not of Abraham negotiating with God, rather Abraham getting an opportunity to explain to us what he thinks justice is. Does that make sense? Yes.
Thought comes up in my mind, collateral damage. That's what it is,
yeah. Collateral damage, yes. It's like, you were in the way, it just happened to be there, sorry, tough luck. So now let's contrast that to Lot's sense of justice. Now here's the difference. Now, and Lot and Abraham, they have the same idea of charity. Giving, giving. I know nothing of you, never met you, who cares? Give anyway. I'll give you more. I'll protect you. Even Lot, offer. I'm sending my two virgin daughters out to be mangled up and destroyed, sodomized, we use the verb, among sodomites, in order to save two strangers I've never met before. Is that sense of charity strong? Absolutely. That's very strong sense of charity. You're going to give and deference. Give these men of great importance and power and strength over your own family, over your own daughters. And say, I would rather see my daughters suffer, whatever they're going to suffer, and death, rather than have these two strangers suffer. So this idea of charity is very, very strong. But what about a sense of justice? Now, in the story of Lot, and the angels talking down, talking to him, I'm going to erase this, I don't need it right now. The angels, of course, bring Lot in, and they blind the people in the door. We'll discuss that shortly. As far as what they can't see, and the people still trying to get in the house. I don't get that, but that's okay. They're still trying to cause harm and cause evil to these individuals. But Lot's sense of justice, what do the angels tell him to do? After they've blinded the people outside, what do the two angels tell Lot and his family to do? Get out. Get your wife, your daughters, your sons, son-in-laws, gather them all and get them out. I'm going to destroy the city. What does Lot do then? Yeah, I'll get to it. He's dragging his feet. He's trying not to go. He's trying to say, no, 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 I'll stay here. I won't pursue this wholeheartedly at all. Lot's sense of justice is very different than Abraham. Lot's not concerned so much what's right and wrong. He's concerned only about his family. His family is what he wants. His sense of justice, because Abraham didn't specify who had to be righteous in Sodom. He just said 10 righteous people. Probably figuring out Lot's family was probably righteous. Lot didn't do that. His sense of family was very strong, so much that because his family, even though his daughters and son-in-laws, both, well, his son-in-law's bigger, thought he was joking. Are you kidding me? I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm not leaving this town. We're fine here. We like whatever we do in the evenings to strangers. Whatever their business is. They enjoy that. They like that recreation. He would rather stay and keep there with his family and continue on the suffering than leave. Different idea of justice. His justice, Lot's justice, is based on his family ties to his daughters and son-in-laws. Even though his son-in-laws and daughters, it says every man from great and old from every quarter of the city were at Lot's door, implying his son-in-law was probably there too. He would rather stick it out and stay in the city than stop the evil. See the sense of justice difference? Abraham's idea was to save righteous people. Lot's idea was to save his family. Different concept of justice. Different idea than what God wanted. God doesn't say, justice for all my family and nobody else. Justice is designed for everybody who needs and deserves justice. That's the idea what Abraham was explaining to us in the idea of the whole whittling down and save all the wicked for the few righteous people. Lot's idea of justice was, no, 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 just save my family. Regardless of what happens to wicked people. Yes.
Yeah, I kind of even question how seriously he wanted to save his family, because if I'm someone who's taking these angels seriously, that they're intending to destroy this entire city. Because it says, I think I would do things a lot differently. I think one thing that I would have done, because it says here, but he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting.
Right, joking.
I would have done something to break them of the notion that I was joking. I would have bowed down. I would have cried.
Done
I would have done
right.
something.
We don't know what he may have done something. We don't know. It doesn't say all of what
he
did.
But it says he appeared to be jesting.
Right.
So I would have done something to break them of the notion that I thought this was funny. To make them stop laughing at me and realize, no, I'm deadly serious. We need to get out of here. And he didn't do that.
So we have an idea of differences between Abraham and Lot. Both from the same family lines, both taught and stand the same idea of charity, of generosity to strangers, Lot very much so. But a different idea of justice. And God didn't choose Lot, did he? Who did he choose? He chose Abraham. So Abraham's sense of justice is stronger or different. It's more in line with what God wanted than Lot's sense of justice. The whole idea of blood thicker than water? No. That's not true. It's what's right is thicker than water. Thicker than blood, thicker than anything. Makes no difference. So the idea, we get the comparison between what justice means to Abraham versus what it means to Lot. To explain the idea of why God would have chosen Abraham over Lot, I hope that explains it pretty well. There's more to it, but this is what we're getting in these stories so far. We're exploring Abraham's life and his thinking. So, a very strong character. So, we don't know all of what Lot went through the past roughly 20 years or thereabouts, how long they've been there. About 25 years. We don't know what all Lot went through, but whatever it was obviously not recorded. And it's not whatever Abraham went through, because God's worked with Abraham in his sense of justice, as well as charity, as well as his trust. And we just explored already Abraham's faith at this point in the stories has weaknesses in his laughing, his believing what God says he's going to do. But his sense of charity and justice are very, very strong. So God's going to continue working for him, working with him, I should say. Continue helping along the way. So that's where the whole Isaac's going to come in and how he winds up getting up on top of a mountain, which we'll get to shortly. Yes.
Just to clear it up, so when the angel finally grabbed the hand of Lot, his wife,
and two daughters,
and that's it.
That's all. The only four that wouldn't come
so
out.
So his sons and his son-in-laws, they were left behind.
Yep. They all preferred the life of Sodom. And his two older daughters. Yeah, they preferred the life of Sodom. Whatever that life entailed, I don't know the details, I don't want to know. But they preferred that life over basically protection or freedom. They were choosing it. We'll discuss some of this more as far as his daughters, the two daughters that came out shortly. Let's see here. So Lot, of course, is afraid to go. He doesn't want to go. What's Lot's wife do? She has the same sense of justice that Lot has. Yes.
Well, you know, part of what David was kind of talking about with the other members of the family, it reminds me of something that, you know, happened there with the congregation in Corinth, where an issue that they had was that they were rejoicing in their tolerance of having someone who was doing something greatly. So one of the things that we see in modern culture is a feeling of intellectual superiority because we tolerate other lifestyles and mm-hmm. such. So it may not have been that they were participating in it.
They may not have been
participating. But they said,
right.
Well, you know, what are you talking about? There's some judgment coming down because of this.
Right.
You know, what's, you know, let them do their thing, I do my thing,
right.
Who cares?
Right. The two of us, we don't cohabitate, we don't agree with each other, we just live next to each other.
Well, the reason I was trying
being in the world versus of it. Yes.
The reason I was thinking about that is because of the 10. You know, when Abraham said, if there's 10, he says, I'll spare everyone.
Yep.
And I don't know what the number, if you add his two daughters and his sons and their son-in-laws, if that was 9 or if that was 11.
At least it'd be 9, but it could have been, if he had a son too, you have, you know, a few more, or 9, so at least 9. So you could add them up. I think Abraham was intending there'd be at least 10. I don't know how many children Lot originally had. It doesn't say. He has at minimum 4 daughters, at minimum, because it says sons-in-laws, as plural. So there's more than one son-in-law. That means he has at least 2 daughters married. He has 2 daughters with him. So at least 4 daughters. But also the angel said, all right, your sons as well, if he had any. I don't know if he had any. They could have been just generically saying sons, as opposed to specifically by their names. So I don't know if he had any sons or not.
So when Abraham sees Lot, he looks at, you know, the 4 of them, and he's like,
he didn't add anything. He was hoping.
Well,
and Lot's wife didn't make it either. So I guess Abraham only gets 3 out of it. 3 out of the 10 make it through. Lot's wife, we look back and say, oh, she turned around. That's too bad. You know, pillow of salt. Okay, why? Yeah, three made it out. So why'd she turn back? Well, some argue, oh, because she was hoping for her daughters would make it, or some other reason she turned back. It doesn't matter why she turned back. The point is, she was told not to, and Lot was told not to either, and all of them were told not to, and she's the one who disobeyed. I won't say that she was right or wrong for disobeying. That's not my business. I wasn't there. But whatever her reasoning, she's looking back, and I'm guessing, this is my guess, Daniel's opinion, based on Lot's idea of dragging his feet and not wanting to leave on the forsake for his family, she probably had the same feelings. Didn't want to leave for the sake of her family. How many mothers would say, okay, sorry kids, tough luck, you're on your own, versus saying, no, please come. Most mothers would treat their children, assuming they love them, to come, to encourage them to come also, want and desire, your heart is to them. But that would mean that her heart, much like Lot's, is her sense of justice is colored by her family. It's attached to her family. And I think my personal opinion is why she looked behind is because of her family. And Lot's idea of not wanting to leave was because of his family. His idea of trying to get his daughter-in-laws and his son, or daughters, sorry, and his son-in-laws to come out and come with them. That's why my opinion is what this has to do with their family versus any other reason. It's pretty consistent with their behavior, their actions. let's continue on. Where was it? This is something I want to point out to you as well. It's important to note or to remember. Is verse... I didn't write the verse number down. It explains the reason as to why God saved Lot. I think it's the tail end. There it is. Verse 29. And so it was when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham. So he sent Lot from amidst the upheaval when he overturned the cities which Lot had lived. So what was God's reason for saving Lot? Abraham. Was it because Lot's sense of charity that he saved him? No. Was it Lot's sense of justice and family he saved him? No. What was it? All because of Abraham's sense of charity, justice, and how to teach and raise his children. That's the reason for kindness to Abraham, why God saved Lot. That was the agreement. And the angel told Lot, I can do nothing until you get to this city you spoke of, the Zoar city. I can't do it until you get there. So it was an agreement that the reason we're saving you, the reason we're bringing you out, has nothing to do with you. It's strictly because of Abraham. That's it. I mean, your righteousness isn't worth anything, Lot. It's Abraham's. It's the only reason why we're doing this. Okay? It's a good, another, a good example or a sense of what God's idea of justice is and why he does something and chooses one person over another. Let's continue on. Any questions so far about the, you know, destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and the whole process? So we go through his daughters. Yes, Susanna.
Didn't come out.
Only two.
Only two of the four?
Of the at least four. They could have had more than four, but he had at least four daughters. Because it says sons-in-law, plural. You can't have more than one son-in-law unless you have at least two daughters married to them. And those did not come out. They stayed behind. But his two daughters, who, as it spoke earlier, to he was trying to save the two angels, had not known a man. That means they're not married. So his two daughters who did not come out. They were not. They had no spouse they were attached to. However, it does state there was at least a man they were betrothed to, at least one of them was, who didn't make it out. He stayed behind for whatever reason. We'll discuss that shortly, actually. We're still seeing it right now. So Lot goes from Zoar, this is verse 30 of chapter 19. He leaves from Zoar to sit on the mountains where the angels, of course, told him to go to begin with. His two daughters, he was afraid to remain for Zoar. He dwelt in a cave. The old one says the younger, our father's old, no man of land to marry us in the usual manner. Let us ply our father with wine and lie with him that we give life to offspring through our father. They plied the father with wine that night. The old one came and lied with the father, and he was not aware of her lying down and getting up. Of course, next day, the old one said the younger, behold, I lied with my father last night. This night, ply with wine again, and you come lie with him. And of course, didn't know when it came up, when she had come up or lay down or come up. So the two daughters conceived by their father, the old one bore a son, she called his name Moab, ancestor Moab, and Ammon. Okay, we read that already. I'm going to rattle off there's a write down a phrase. There is a detail. This section is recorded in a particular way. I'm going to erase some of this because I don't need it anymore. Of what his daughters were doing. In particular, what they were thinking. That's the reason, really. That's what we want to find out. Why would they do that? What were they thinking? Are they crazy? Most would say yes, but some would say no. I would say yes, that's all right. Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. So, the Levirate marriage, or Levirate marriage, or Levitical marriage. What that verse states, which, well, actually, we'll just go and read that. We'll just read it so you can recall what it states. So Deuteronomy 25, this is a law that God gives. And we'll read it, and we'll say, well, that has nothing to do with Lot and his daughters, because that's absurd. That has to do with brothers and brothers, not fathers and daughters. But there's a word phrase in here that ties them together. So Deuteronomy 25, in verse 5, it says, if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man should not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of the husband's brother to her. To or in. To and on. Two Hebrew words. El, and that's a ayin. It's all. Unpronounceable, a funky sound. Deuteronomy 25:5, the Levitical marriage is on. Any other instance, it's in. I mean, you went into your wife, you went into her, she went into blah, blah, blah. It's all going into. In this record for Lot and his daughters, they said on. In the case with Tamar and Judah, it's always in. Any point, the entire Bible is always going into her. But this is on. There is a huge difference between them in Hebrew. In the concept and the idea between them. One is a sense of having relations. The in. The other is a sense of pure responsibility. It is a burden to take. You must then endure this burden. These two daughters were not interested in their father saying, "Ooh, wow, he looks good," the old man. It was strictly a sense of responsibility to do something. Their duty as descendants and their father's descendants. I am not saying they're justified. My point is, their mental state of being was, they both had a sense of, we need to do something. And then we will endure the burden that it requires to continue on our father's line. Because otherwise we could be wiped out. As far as they're concerned, the whole world's wiped out. Look around them. Granted, Zoar was still around, but most of Sodom, all the betrothed people that were their potential mates were all wiped out. They're all gone. So both these daughters use this phrase on purpose in this instance with Lot. They are taken as a responsibility to continue on their father's offspring. Having nothing to do with, I just want to have a kid. I just can't handle it anymore. I'll never get married. It doesn't even mean married. It has to do with the responsibility for the father's lives, what they were after. That's how, when the Bible uses a phrase and it ties it in two spots and nowhere else, there's a reason. So in this idea, God's pointing out and through the Torah, the daughter's idea was a sense of duty, responsibility, and it was going to be an on them, as in it is a burden on them, not upon their father or anybody else. They were trying to procreate or continue on their father's line as a sense of duty, which a son would do. A son follows the line by getting married, have kids. Well, if Lot had any sons, they're all dead. He didn't have any kids left. No one else could continue on the family line. So who's left? Two daughters. So who continues on the family line? No one. They took it upon themselves to do so. Yes?
Interesting, because later on, there are two Moabites and possibly two Ammonites
yes.
that become in Yeshua's line.
And yes, it's almost like they come back.
The DNA was sort of like saved for later on.
It was used again. It was used again. It's on purpose. Right. So this idea, God honored his two daughters in that method, and that their sense of responsibility was strong in them. And as a result, their descendants both Moab and Ammon, because David's sons, one's from Moab and one was from, I can't remember. No, one's Moabite, one of his sons. Yeah, anyway, a lot of family lines come along the way. So Moab, I know for certain. And Ammon, I can't recall if any of their descendants not. I don't remember off the top of my head. But Moab, they come back into the family. So God honors Lot and his daughter's decision by bringing their families back around and say, now we're bringing you back into the family. So I'm going to honor this action that these daughters did, this sense of responsibility. Not that God's saying, I agree with you. He didn't say that. He's respecting it. He's honoring their poor choice. I say, because you were still trying to do what was honorable, though you did it wrong, I will still consider this an important thing for you. So I try to cut the two daughters a little slack, just a little bit. It's beyond what I can imagine normally, but still, what their decision making, it was in their own thoughts. They were trying to do a sense of honor to their father, which God then subsequently honors as well. Does it make sense as far as what they were doing? Wrong thing, right reason. That's a good way of putting it. Wrong thing, right reason. Yes.
Can I just backpedal just a second?
Go right ahead.
Thank you. So, I'm in. Let me put my glasses on. So, 18:25. It says, "Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" Now, looking at Abraham, who is justice and judgment, and
justice and charity, yeah.
Yes, and he's saying this in the same format to Yahweh. And then when it jumps forward to, "Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley, that God remembered Abraham." Could he not be referring to the conversation that he had, where he was saying, you know, "You're the judge of the earth, shouldn't you deal justly?" And he's like, well, you know, remembering Abraham, that conversation, he's like, yeah, we have to get Lot and the three out of there, and I'm still good because there's definitely not 10 righteous.
Yes, that is what he's doing. And not just that conversation, but all of Abraham's life. He's remembering Abraham, not just that one instance of the 10 people to get Lot out, but
justice,
all of Abraham.
So
the idea of justice that God is recognizing in Abraham, a sense of charity is recognized in Abraham, he's applying that and why he's bringing Lot through. Now, that's not the only time Lot's been saved. Abraham had to save him many years earlier when the kings came over and captured him and his family. So Lot's been saved more than once, at least in his lifetime. He's slaved from two things. I'll write them both down there. Two things Lot was saved from. The first one was slavery. Lot was saved by, actually, three things, actually, because you say that of the Ur of Chaldeans too, but dominantly as far as Abraham's work with God. The first one is slavery, because what happens to captives when you go to prison or you go to war? What do you do with the captives? In particular, the men. You're slaves. I mean, the girls, they do the things with it. But the men, you're slaves. So Abraham comes along with his, I think it's 400 men or 300, I can't remember off the top of my head, and gathers all the captives from Sodom and brings them all back. That was Abraham's first a saving of Lot. His second saving of Lot was from what? Death. What was going to happen to Lot and his family if Abraham didn't try to intervene, or as Abraham's sense of intervening? Was trying to save, okay, I'm going to negotiate with God. Of course, God already had this plan and preset. But the idea is, because of Abraham's faith and sense of justice, Lot got saved from slavery the first time on Abraham's idea of, wait a minute, we need to go save this guy. And the second time, got saved from death when God said, I'm going to honor Abraham and I will save Lot. So both instances of slavery and death saved Lot and his family, all because of Abraham's sense of charity, justice, and faith in God. So it's Abraham's belief, his ideas, his whole life is the reason Lot is even around. It's all because of Abraham. Not just one conversation, but repeatedly, because it happened many years earlier with slavery that Lot survived. So it's many things within Abraham that God is honoring in the process of doing this. Yeah, oops, two hands up. Go ahead.
But, you know, I think the confusion, if there is confusion, has to do with the Hebrew and the way it's translated, because God is justice. He is just, period. And he was going to perform justice, period.
It was preset.
And remember, Abraham was growing in his faith. So this was a way of him growing too.
Yeah, the objective in the story which we're reading about Abraham, it's about Abraham, not so much about God. In the story we're reading about Lot and how God saves him and the method which he chose, God explains he's doing this to honor Abraham, but the methodology he's choosing is just getting him through. Lot by himself isn't worthy of that much. And mind you, I say that because imagine for a moment you're a righteous person and you live in Sodom. How long are you to stay there? Not long. He's been there for 20 years. So, okay, you have to measure, okay, how did Abraham live in Sodom? No. Even 20 years earlier when he had to save Lot, he said, I don't even want anything to do with you, King of Sodom. You're awful. Don't anybody ever claim that I earned money from you. You're not worth it. So Abraham's idea of Sodom was already, I'm staying away from that place. It's not trustworthy. So Abraham's righteousness was pretty strong. Well, Lot's righteous, Lot too, but not strong enough to get him out of the city. Yes. Tell me.
Well, you're asking earlier about Moab and Ammon.
Mm-hmm. Did Ammon make it back in? I can't remember.
Yes, Ammonite Naamah, wife of King Solomon and mother of King Rehoboam.
Okay. Thank you. So the Ammonites did make it back in. Does that answer your question so far, or kind of? It's the idea we're trying to explore. maybe. But because of honor to Abraham, he brought Lot out. So he saved him from death. Let's continue on. I see a little cool in here. I should turn the furnace back on. Let's see. What's any questions about this section? We'll jump to chapter 20 for the take two. take two. Okay, this happened and it failed miserably in Egypt. So I have a question for you. If you have a plan and you do something and it fails, would you go do it again? What was that?
Isn't that the definition of
insanity? The definition of insanity. Expecting a different result. You think, okay, come on, Abraham. You went through Egypt. Pharaoh kidnapped your wife, took her as his own, almost, but didn't quite use her. And it failed awful. It just was a complete disaster. But he got a whole bunch of stuff out of it. So you kind of wait. Okay, is Abram saying, yeah, honey, I'm going to gamble with you. I'm going to throw the dice. I think they won't take you, so I get lots of stuff out of it. Or is his mind not working correctly and saying, wait a minute, you failed 20 years earlier. Can you not get the picture and do it right this time? Yes, Alvar.
I thought God told Abraham to go to those places.
He did.
It was a commandment.
Well, he told him to go to Canaan. I don't recall. And there's a famine happened in Canaan when shortly after Abraham arrived. And they left Canaan and went to Egypt. I don't recall if God told him to go to Egypt or not. I don't remember that. He may have. I don't remember. That'd be back in I think Genesis, I think it's like 14, I think. Let's look that up to find out for certain. I can't remember if God told him to go or not. In the case of Gerar, God didn't tell Abraham to leave. Abraham left because look, all of his trading partners and the businesses he used to do his business with. What happened to all the cities? They're burned up. Oh, let's sell our sheep to the ashes. They don't pay for sheep, do they? What do you got to do then? Go find a new populated town. Let's go sell our stuff and goods over to the Philistines in Gerar, right? They've got money. We'll deal with money then. Now, I'm presuming by the time Abraham gets to Gerar, they probably, the word would happen to Sodom and Gomorrah. The knowledge about it was probably well spread by then, because it's not that far of a trek. So I imagine the people, the king of Gerar, the Abimelech, probably knew, hey, look what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. They're literally toast. So let's not become like them. So he has some idea, or the king of Abimelech, the king of Gerar, Abimelech is his name, has an idea of the power that is out there. Because he can see the ruins of Sodom and Gomorrah and all the ash heap that's now there. Not a big shocking thing. So the idea that he knows or understands God to some degree is legit. He knows something about God. Maybe not everything, but Abimelech knows something about him. He has this great power at least to wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham, take two. So he goes down there. All right, you know, she's my sister, and you have blah, yada, yada. We're not going to go through all the details of what happens there. Actually, so this is the tail end of chapter 20. Abimelech, of course, has these dreams, and God had done something to him and to his household. My translation says he had, at the tail end, after Abraham prays for him, the orifice of the household, all the orifices of the house of Abimelech, he had to be healed because they were completely constrained. Some of yours will say the wombs, various other parts, body parts were constrained. Either way, Abimelech was not able to have any relations with anybody in his household. Right, that's his issue. If it's every orifice, that includes he can't poop and pee either. That's going to hurt. In case you're not aware of that. That's going to hurt real quick. You'd be blown pretty quick. That would imply also that of his whole household, so all the women and the maidservants as well. So everybody in his household is going to feel discomfort by an extreme amount. However God chose to do it, I'm assuming Abimelech figured this out rather quickly, that I'm not going to hang out for a month not pooping and peeing. Hopefully by that night he realized something's not right. Let's fix this quickly. So God fixed the situation rather quickly, which is good for him, good for Abimelech because he was able to live. Abraham's reasoning, of course, was again, did he trust God? Abraham's reasoning. His reasoning for saying that she's my sister, not my wife. It shows, again, doesn't it seem like a lack of trust or lack of faith in God to that? Yes, Kat. He is a wanderer, that's true. He does wander through the land as far as, because he's going to run across various types of people from all different belief systems. So Abraham, in these stories alone, there's other stories as well. We already discussed the laughing, and we already had the previous, the sister for a Pharaoh / wife, whatever that, what do you want to call it? The laughing, both he and Sarah, so Abraham and Sarah both have a laughing issue with Isaac. Of course, Abraham now has another sister / wife with Abimelech. This one here was with Egypt. This is the Philistines. So both these issues seem to have a repetition of lack of trust in God or lack of faith. Yet Abraham has great faith because he believed God. So Abraham's sense of charity is strong. His sense of justice is strong. His sense of faith is growing. It's growing. It's improving as it goes along. We think, well, how is this an improvement from Pharaoh to, you know, Abimelech? 20-ish years go by. He's almost 30 years now. Between these events, how is that showing growth in Abraham's faith? It's not showing growth in his faith in the fact of his sister wife issue. It's showing Abraham and how God's going to get him out of this one. It shows Abraham how God got him out. In the case of Pharaoh, he got him out a particular way, which would just reveal to Pharaoh what's going on. In the case of Abimelech, what'd God do? Well, Sarah's going to tell exactly Abraham exactly what happened to Abimelech and his family, that look what God did. His power is pretty strong. So in these instances, the laughing is, we'll talk about that shortly. The sisters of Pharaoh's issues, as far as they learned that he was a wife, because God talks to Pharaoh, says, you can't do this. And Abimelech may have a physical problem that God's showing up. So Abraham is seeing God's handiwork in these events. Yes?
Isn't there also the difference of one, God sent him and told him to do this, and one was his own doing? And will you have the same blessing? You know, will you have the same covering if you're doing something of your own decision to move? You know what I mean? Like there's sometimes, sometimes when he's telling you to do it, you expect that covering,
right? Versus when you do it on your own.
Versus when you're deciding on your own to do it and hoping that he'll still cover you.
That's a fair assessment, because Abraham, God calls him a prophet at this point in the story. So Abraham's sense or understanding of God is expanding, and his sense of trust in God is expanding. And so when Abraham makes a decision, God didn't tell him to go to Gerar. There wasn't a famine. Of course, may have lack of customers, but it wasn't a famine. He needed to go somewhere, so he chose Gerar to go. And Abraham still believed or understood that Philistines didn't have a sense or understanding of who God truly was. But yet, Also, the Philistines observed what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah at the same time. They may not understand what God really was, but they understood his power. Once you understand his power, you have a sense of respect. That, of course, can translate through, okay, this prophet or this individual from God has or earns or deserves a sense of respect because of what God can do to Sodom and Gomorrah, he can do to you too. Now, Abimelech does this grandiose thing in this dream. He says, would you destroy a whole nation? Talking to God in the dream about this about Sarah. Now, God didn't close the orifices of the whole nation. It was just Abimelech and his family alone that God seemed to have closed. That's what he fixed. So Abimelech has a sense of righteous justice, righteous indignation. Hey, I'm innocent. You're punishing all these people unnecessarily so. And God's pointing out, no, it didn't. It was you and your family that I'm dealing with. And the only saving grace you're going to have, the only way you're going to get out of this, is if you return the wife and Abraham prays for you. So now we have a sense of Abraham's faith is now going to require something of Abraham. Not just his belief, it requires his actions to save somebody else too, through prayer. Abraham has to pray to get Abimelech and his wife and daughters or maids back to normal functioning again. Abraham, his faith is now expanding from God take care of me to, okay God, what do I need to do? There's more to it. That's God's methodology of improving Abraham's faith. It's, okay Abraham, now you know the power I have. Now let's move forward so you know what are you going to do with it? Abraham, here's a task for you. You have to go pray for this individual who kidnapped your wife and was going to use her as his own. Sorry, that's hard for men to pray for. I'm just being honest. Oh, hey, look, you kidnapped my wife. Okay, I'll pray for you to Satan. It's not easy. I'm just volunteering my own thoughts. That's not easy to do.
It's the lesson where it actually affects both parties. You know, Abimelech learns from it.
Right.
As well as Abraham.
It does. I'm not going to have time to cover all this stuff. It's taking too long, so I apologize. I'm going to jump forward a little bit. Any questions so far about Abimelech's issues? Hopefully not. Yes, go ahead.
Just looking it up, but do you know about where Gerar is in Israel, Daniel? Because it's about this point where he says, my land is before you, live
yeah,
wherever you like.
Yeah, there's a map. I got a map somewhere here. I'll draw a map. I like maps. Gerar, it was renamed. What was it renamed to? Gerar was renamed. Oh, crud. What was his name? No. It's the southern end of the Philistine territory. But I don't recall its original spot. Quick map of Israel. There's Mount Carmel. Jerusalem's roughly about here. Abraham's been hanging out most of his life around this territory here. Well, this whole region, actually. Philistine territory along here. And there's Egypt down this direction. This is a map of Israel, roughly. Gath up here. Gaza down there. Gerar was in this southern territory area, but I don't remember the exact spot. I've forgotten the exact spot. It was renamed years later, but I don't remember what it was renamed to.
Southern territory of Gaza?
So it'd be literally right here, right at the very, very bottom end. Because Gaza was the southern territory of Israel, or of Philistines. So that's, the southern area, the southern spot. Okay. Any questions? Make sense? I move forward. I move a little further, a little faster. So any questions so far regarding the story of what happens in 20, the take two, the attempt number two? All right. I'm going to have next 10 minutes. I'm going to cover this as best I can. Okay, Sarah has a baby. And roughly a year later goes by. Not the exact year, but close to it. She has a baby, Isaac. And Ishmael and Isaac, after Isaac gets weaned, are playing. There's a mocking. Playing. There's also persecuting. Teasing is a good word. All of these are making sport. That's also opposite as well. All these are essentially synonyms to each other. You wouldn't know the difference until you had the context. Is he referring to playing, as in like being playful? O is referring to mocking, making fun of, persecuting, making, causing pain and injury to the other individual, or just making fun of, teasing, as far as, you know, name calling and such. Any one of those are legit words translations for this application. We wouldn't know what they were just by that alone. It just wouldn't tell us. We would know what he was doing. Whatever it is, Sarah didn't care for it. However, fortunately, Galatians tells us what it was. Galatians 4 explains a little bit more detail as far as the problem with Ishmael and Isaac. Galatians 4, jump to verse 21. Galatians 4, verse 21. Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? It is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and the free woman through promise, which things are symbolic. These are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and corresponds to Jerusalem, which is now and is in bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of all. For it is written, rejoice, O barren, you who do not bear, break forth and shout, you who do not travail. For the desolate has many more children and than she who has a husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of the promise. But as he who was born according to the flesh then persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, what does Scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. Then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. So in his instance, in Galatians, Paul's jumping on the idea, this action of whatever he was doing, whatever Ishmael was doing to Isaac, he focuses it more on the persecuting concept, the persecuting idea. So his explanation is, Ishmael was treating Isaac in a persecuting fashion, hence what got Sarah so angry. But in this sense, he then ties and says, that's the difference between a bond, a bondwoman's son or a bond son, and a free son. So these are the ideas what we're looking at. Does a slave like the people who are its master? Not generally. Slaves typically don't like masters too often. Now some do, but most generally don't. The slave, what's the little statement? Misery loves company. Slaves would like to have everybody else miserable as they are. Why? Because misery loves company. It likes to have camaraderie. So in the time of the Apostle Paul was speaking, writing out the book of Galatians, as well as other writings he had as well at the same time or similar times, he was combating the idea that there are those who are under the law, meaning here's all of the traditions of men, as well as traditions of the Torah, how you must obey them and obey this way. If you don't, you die. And those saying, wait a minute, God has a lot more grace than this. We can actually function and live and not necessarily die from our issues and all of our problems. Well, the bond, in this case, what Paul was pointing out to, this would be the those who are bound by Jerusalem's idea of the Hagar. So bound in Jerusalem, in the concept of Hagar. Versus, and these individuals, this whole Jerusalem and Hagar, this whole idea of let's persecute those who believe in Messiah versus those who don't. That's where the bond woman, bond servant, bond son comes from. That idea. So the idea of persecution. Now, what was Saul's concept of persecution? What was he doing when he was persecuting people? He was killing them. And he was arresting them. And what other people at his time persecuted those who believed in Messiah? They were killing and arresting. So was a persecuting a good thing or a bad thing? Bad. So if he's pointing out that Hagar and Isaac are like those persecuting the believers in Messiah, what was he going to argue? What would that tell us about the actions of Ishmael against Isaac? Persecuting to cause harm, to cause danger, in a particular way to cause injury or make his life hard or difficult. That's the action he's doing. That's the action he's acting like. That appears to be Galatians' explanations for how Paul is pointing out. So Ishmael's intent is to cause difficult harm, some kind of injury or whatever it may be, whatever it is. Then Sarah got after. So when we point out that, and Sarah says, "Get rid of her, get out of here, get this, that will not be part of it," and Abraham was so upset. And God says, no, do what Sarah says. What she's saying is right. Because what does God know? He knows the future. He knows the symbol that's going to be happening. These individuals, who are the bond children, the bondwoman's descendants, need to be separated from the free descendants. They wouldn't work together. They don't cohabitate well. A slave does not cohabitate well with their master. They just don't. Make sense so far? So that, go ahead. You're...
So I heard some commentaries that maybe he was actually molesting a sexual idea.
I've heard that once before. I personally have rejected it pretty quickly. Okay. Because if that was the instance, it's very upsetting. Right. But whatever he was physically doing, if it was like a sexual molestation issue, this parallel that Paul pulls wouldn't fit very well. Because the people who were persecuting were not trying in a sexual sense to corrupt those who were free. They tried to bring them back into what they perceived was the right way to be correct instead of being free and doing things incorrect. So they're trying to guide them into something that was right in their eyes versus what is not right. I have in the past rejected the sexual connotation behind it. Even though, yes, it is the same words used for Rebecca and Isaac, it doesn't necessarily apply in this instance because then this parallel that Paul pulls doesn't fit so well. Yes?
Just briefly, because right after that they talk about inheritance, you know, and they're both really kids. I mean, Isaac was just weaned. Isn't it more like, I'm going to get the inheritance?
Yeah, something like that. It could be. It could be like a teasing issue. That goes to me that I'm the firstborn, you're really not, all that stuff. Because it doesn't say what the words he was specifying. We don't know how he was persecuting, how he was teasing. In this instance, when the persecuting process with Paul, there are a lot of conversations, and along the same lines were spoken of too. Like, who were the descendants of Abraham, who aren't? Now, you guys aren't circumcised, you're not going to be descendants of Abraham, I get the inheritance, you don't. That same idea is still there. So it could be that concept. I don't know for certain. We don't know for certain. The idea of I'm going to get, I'm the firstborn son, you're not. That concept between Ishmael and Isaac. Because Ishmael technically is the firstborn son of Abraham, but not from Sarah. But Isaac's the one who gets all the blessings, all the rewards, all the inheritance goes to him. But Ishmael's like, wait a minute, I'm the firstborn son. It should go to me. It's an argument being that way. But Isaac at this point in time would be like 2, maybe 3 years old. Do you argue well with a 2 or 3 year old? No, but you can influence them pretty strongly, can't you? You can change their entire lives by influencing them over and over and over again, day after day after day, and they finally believe it when they're an adult. It's like an elephant. They don't forget. So if Ishmael and Isaac were stayed together, Ishmael could, in fact, have inherited all of Abraham's property and everything else he owned by just convincing Isaac. It'd be easy give. Because Isaac would say, oh yes, Ishmael, you're the firstborn. I look up to you. So Ishmael, he's about 14 at this time, maybe 14, 15 years old. He can easily influence a 2 or 3 year old boy as the boy grows up all the way to manhood. You got 20 years there. So you can influence it. And that's where Sarah comes in. Hey, no, separate them. Don't allow that influence to mess up our son. Abraham is upset, of course, then that's how the separation occurs. Go ahead.
But even if you look at, you talked about the bond son, and the free son. Isaac was free, but look at the Hebrew people even today. We are the chosen people.
Right.
You feel it.
It's the same. Not much has changed. Been over 2,000 years, and it's the same concept is still there. We're the sons of Abraham. We're not. You aren't, but we are. It's the same argument, same thing. Nothing's changed. Yes.
I think Isaac was not 3. He was more like 6, 7 years.
It could be. I don't know the exact age. What age they're weaned at. I'm not sure what... I mean, our kids are weaned at, you know, between 2 and 3 years old. I don't know at that time whether it was longer or shorter. I couldn't tell you. maybe Sarah kept him... I mean, she's nursing it the first time. Maybe she wanted to keep him longer. I don't know. Yes?
I think it's not uncommon in any family structure to be submissive to your older sibling.
It is.
And it is a training that they do, and you tend to go, okay. Mm-hmm. And if they have that exposure, he would, with a gap in age that much, he would look up to Ishmael and be like, oh, okay. If he's there constantly saying, hey, do what I said. Hey, do what I said.
Mm-hmm.
It just would naturally occur.
It would occur that way. It would occur that way. Let's move on forward. Okay. Chapter 22. I'm going to cover this the next 2 minutes. Any questions, chapter 22? It's pretty straightforward. We know the story of Isaac's binding, right? It's not shocking. We know it's symbolic of Messiah's binding. We know what that process is, the 3 days and all the journey. We know the story really, really well, the Akedah. It's not surprising of what's happening. But the only thing I want to focus on in particular about this is that we've seen how Abraham's faith and his sense of justice and charity in the stories we've read so far, and there's more to it, by the way, not just what I covered today, has grown and developed up to the point where he can actually go do this. Yes.
You might get to this, but I have heard or read that Isaac was probably around 40 years old when this happened.
Thereabouts. Okay. 30 to 40, somewhere in that range. It's pretty commonly believed. Yeah, some argue 37 exactly. I don't know for certain with the exact age, but pretty close to it. He would be in that range, that age. Which... I couldn't say that for certain. In the Torah, it explains that you are wholly responsible for everything by the age of 20. 20 years and up, you are completely responsible. If regardless of how I had a good childhood, I had a bad childhood, I had this bad dad or that dad, who cares? 20 years and up, everything you do is all on you. Now, that's the Torah explains. Now, Torah is not written at this time in Abraham. They're written a few years later. And I say that because when they came out of Egypt, and God says, okay, 40 years in the wilderness, right? I'm going to put you 40 years in the wilderness. Everybody who was 20 and up dies. That was God's explanation. That means those who were under 20 were not considered responsible for the actions that was happening in the wilderness of wandering around in Egypt. Or not Egypt, sorry, the Arabian desert. So that would imply that God's saying, hey, I'm capping it. 20, under 20, you are still subject to your parents. 20 and up, you're all on your own. You can't figure things out by now. Tough luck. You're paying for them anyway. That's how the Torah explains. So it's 20 and up. I couldn't tell you what Abraham's thought was, whether it was 20 at that time or not. I couldn't. Could have been 40. I don't know. But there's a reason why I think he chose 40 or 37. Yes.
I was just gonna say, if you add everything up when Sarah, how old she was, mm-hmm. and then you keep on adding, the Torah is very specific on that. He is 37 years old.
So 37. Fair enough. Now, you have to ask yourself, okay, so how did an old man, Abraham, being 137, bind up his 37-year-old son, who's probably about twice as strong as he is, voluntarily? Isaac would have to have voluntarily allowed himself to be bound. And why would he voluntarily do that? He was submissive. What was Messiah supposed to do? Isaac did know who God was. So Isaac is voluntary. What was Messiah? Voluntary. I'm going to quote. Messiah is the same. Isaac is a type of messianic figure in the story. The execution or the near execution of Isaac is supposed to remind us of the symbolic process which Messiah went through. So Messiah voluntarily went. God didn't say, get out, kick him in the pants, go kill yourself. I'm going to make this happen. No, it was voluntary. It's important that Isaac be voluntary in this process. So Isaac is a complicit voluntary member of this process. I'm not sure at what point Isaac realized he was the one who's going to be killed. I don't know whether it was the moment when he asked Abraham, hey, here's the wood, here's the knife, whether that was the point he realized it was going to be himself, or whether it was after Abraham said, here's the rope. I'm not sure. I don't know what point Isaac realized it, but at some point he did. He had to have voluntarily done it. Because the upper 30s-year-old man is not going to succumb to almost 140-year-old man. You physically don't succumb to that. Granted, if you, I know Abraham lived really long. We don't live that long anymore and all that stuff. But you scale it all down. Your average mid-20s can take out an 80-year-old man pretty good. Yes, Kate.
Well, Christ didn't go into it blindly.
He didn't. You know, it was Abraham, fully open.
His dad told him this is what's going to happen.
Right.
And he had the option. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure because they liken each other that Abraham probably said, hey, this is what I was told. You know, I mean, just as a parent looking at...
Sarah would know too.
Right.
So Abraham and Sarah had to have both known this event was going to happen. And at some point, somewhere along the line, Isaac had to be informed, either when he's laying on the altar or something. He realized something's not quite right. Yes.
But it says something about all three of them, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac. And Isaac, that their faith finally matured to the peak.
Right. They did.
Because
they,
no one loves, no greater love hath a person than to give their life for their
faith. Right. Yep. Amen. Exactly. So each of them have that they're faith, and Isaac is called, God's called the fear of Isaac for a reason. My personal opinion, there's probably a time which Isaac really started to fear God at this moment, or at least pretty soon to it. But this is a voluntary event on Isaac's part. It's really important we understand it's a voluntary event. Because in Messiah's case, it's a voluntary event. He chooses to do it. He knows the consequences. It has to be voluntary. If it's forced on you, it doesn't make much sense anymore. It wouldn't be he died for my sin. No, he was murdered by God for my sins. It would be different than he voluntarily died. There's a huge difference between the two of them. Oh, yeah, murder. Yeah, making a martyr out of him. So, it makes sense for what the story is? All right. In this section, I don't have time to cover it all. I'm past your time already. We've seen or watched Abraham grow in the stories in his faith. As I mentioned when I started out here, God didn't say, Abraham, come out of Ur of Chaldeans and go kill your son on the mountaintop. That wouldn't have worked. Abraham said, are you kidding me? I'll go find some other pagan god to observe. Why would I go observe yours? It's worthless. God worked Abraham's faith through the time of believing and developing and growing it. For finally, Abraham had to do something, and now his faith is truly tested. There's a reason why Abraham says it wasn't tested up till this point. This was his true test. Does faith mean anything? Is it worth anything? Was it worth God's effort? It was or wasn't. And now Abraham gets to demonstrate it was. Which is why all of us are still here today. I'm not going to go through any details regarding this. It's beyond my time. Any questions or comments? I know it took you a long time. Overtime already, but go ahead.
I'm just still a little bit confused about whose land Ishmael and Isaac is in the inheritance, like what land? I'm just a little confused. Where does Ishmael fall into place of the land?
You know, that's a complex question, and I don't think I can cover it today. It has to do with mapping and migration patterns and everything else, so who gets what? Isaac's territory, which of course goes to Jacob, is specifically the land of Canaan. That was given specifically to Abraham when Abraham first arrived. So we know land of Canaan today, for the most part, is Israel, modern-day Israel today. That's the dominant... Marker's terrible. That's the dominant territory that belonged to him. When you deal with Ishmael and you deal with Esau later on, all their territories were sent away from here. So Abraham, by the way, has many more sons than just these two. He has lots and lots of sons. He sends them all east. So they all go that way. He sends them all there. Midian, I forgot all the names. A whole bunch of them. They all go that way. And they spread out, and they spread down south. They cover the whole territory. We would call it essentially modern-day Saudi Arabia. That's as well as Yemen and Oman, that territory as well of the Arabian Peninsula. That's where all of Abraham's descendants ended up going, except Isaac. Isaac and Jacob as well were all confined at this territory of Israel was all theirs. So physical space, that's what was belonged to. Make sense? So it's a separation of who inherited what. Abraham's other children inherited all the rest of it. But this territory was specifically for Isaac and his descendants. Those are different. This is more of a discussion separate. that's how to describe those. Those other tribes, the subsects and other groups. There's, oh crud. I don't think I have time to cover that today. I'm terribly sorry. When you're dealing with the different subgroups of all different categories of each descendant, they do a host of different things. And they inherit a host of different places. And they migrate to different places too. So you will have, for example, we call them diasporas or exoduses or captivities, that armies come in and take a chunk, we'll just take this chunk, and cast it from here over to there. So that group of people just got moved. Well, that group of people just got moved will now procreate with others in that area. But they'll bring a mix of their knowledge tradition with the mix of knowledge tradition which is there. So you have a new subgroup that's invented. It's a mix of other groups together. And they come with new names for them as well. That didn't happen just to Israel. It happened to all of these groups. All the descendants of Abraham, at one time or another, get captured and taken away and moved to other places. And they're all scattered around. So we don't have the exact, you know, the line of Abraham, per se, to know who became what. Some of them got wiped out completely, just out of destroyed. But some were just cast away and moved around a bit. So we have a mix of all these things, and as a result, you have a mix of all the inheritance, all different territories, and who owns, who earns what. But what never was supposed to change is this territory still belongs to descendants of Isaac, which would include Jacob and Esau, but Esau purposefully rejected it. So Esau got cast out with his brethren out there, his cousins, I guess you call them. Yes, Don.
The Muslims claim that Abraham and his descendants, and they... thus, are those descendants, they were Muslims. That's what they
right,
were.
Right. Yeah. Most of them argue they're Muslim today.
Yeah.
And if you look in the world map, they are. They are. Well, Arab is a generic term. It means mixed. So you think, if I'm Arab, I'm mixed. It's like we call them a mutt or an American today. Because what's your descendancy? Well, I don't know. What's mine? I don't know. From this country, that country, this person, who knows where I'm from? I'm a mutt. Like most of us, we're all mutts, most of us. The Arab is mutt. It means you're a mix. So it wouldn't be just Arab, it would be a whole host of people. You have the Arabs, the mixture of all the descendants of Abraham are shoved in there, as well as many descendants of Babylon, many descendants that came from Assyria, many descendants that came from Syrians in general, as well as Abraham's brothers who had children too. They're all mixed together. They're a mix, an Arab, a mix. Arab today is referred to a category, a group of people who have a generalized similar language and similar belief system. That doesn't mean they're all biologically the same. It means their belief and their language is the same. There's the Persian, and then there's the, which is Mesa, Iran, and then there's the, what's one on the other side of Iran? Pashtun, yeah, that guy said Pashtun area. So they live in there's hundreds of subgroups, and none of them like each other. Lots of wars there, right? They don't like, the Kurds are exactly, lots of subgroups. It's when you mix them together, you have these mixes, and mixes don't always mix well. So that's where all the wind up coming from. The idea of the Muslim belief is a totally different topic, and we're not covering that today. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Just one more thing. When you say justice, righteousness and justice comes from the word tzedakah, which means doing righteousness, which righteousness means God's commandments. Mm-hmm. And justice comes from the word mishpatim, which are all the commandments that are towards the neighbor. Mm-hmm. So if you have commandments, that's how you're righteous. Mm-hmm.
So. Which embodies Abraham, what he did, how he treated his neighbors, as well as how he treated God. Any questions or comments? Thank you for your time. We'll close with a prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for this Shabbat and giving us time to be with one another, to learn your ways, to be kind servants, Father, please guide us and teach us what is well and what is just, that we'll teach our children, grandchildren, as they should learn and what they should know and how they should treat one another, how they treat your people, how they treat their families, and how they treat you. Father, please help us to be strong and be wise. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L dot I-N-F-O. Hallel.info. Hallel.info.